From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's often noted that the worst of times can be the best of times for news organizations. On September 11th, nearly 80 million viewers watched primetime broadcast or cable. Untold numbers listened to the radio. There was a stampede to newspaper and TV websites. Americans were united by what they saw.
The entire building has just collapsed.
The whole side has collapsed?
The whole building has collapsed.
A survey conducted last November by the Pew Research Center for People in the Press found that the news media were, at last, winning the respect of their audience. Andrew Kohut is the director of the Pew Center.
I think it's safe to say that it was the most positive review of the American news media that we've ever recorded and perhaps has ever been recorded in a public opinion poll. The public had a great need to know, and 80 to 90% said, boy, the news media has done a great job in delivering this important story to us.
9/11, the day 9/11, was the defining moment for my generation of journalists.
CNN Newsnight anchor Aaron Brown.
We had waited a long time, I think, for that moment. Our generation had been defined by OJ and Princess Diana, and we proved that we were very much prepared to handle the biggest story of our lives. I'm incredibly proud of my business on 9/11 and in the days and weeks and mostly the months afterward.
The Pew survey found the public also gave high marks to the media's patriotism, and newsmakers and news watchers took note. Advertisers threatened to pull ads from local news programs whose anchors declined to wear flag pins. Commentators' remarks were parsed for undue skepticism toward administration pronouncements. Fox News Channel found it advantageous to snipe at the patriotism of its rival CNN. And when LA Times TV critic Howard Rosenberg wrote a column suggesting that the president looked stiff and boyish in his first appearance after the attacks, he was buried under an avalanche of hate mail.
I got approximately 900 emails, 99.5% of which were harshly critical, calling me, Osama bin Rosenberg, equating me with the terrorists, ordering me out of the country, ordering me not to write again, ordering me to die. That was the tone.
Rosenberg says he wished he'd waited a day, but actually it took much of the media much longer than that to question the performance of American institutions, to find out why Air Force fighters were unable to intercept the planes, why the FBI and the immigration authorities failed to keep known terrorists out of the country, whether poor coordination among New York City authorities contributed to the death toll of firefighters that day. Early on, there seemed to be little appetite for scrutinizing our heroes and our leaders. In fact, even as journalists pressed the Pentagon for greater access to the war, CNN's chief of standards and practices wrote in a memo to correspondents that we must remain careful not to focus excessively on the casualties and the hardships that will inevitably be a part of this war, or to forget that it is the Taliban leadership that is responsible for the situation Afghanistan is now in.
Journalists closely paralleled the language of the U.S. government leaders, and they had opportunities to not do that.
University of Washington communications professor David Domke led a study that scrutinized 210 Time and Newsweek stories published in the first 5 weeks after the attacks. He says those magazines gave little space to critics who questioned the government's actions for three reasons. The mood of the public was one, and the natural patriotism of the American press corps was another. The third, and possibly most important, was the lack of dissent on Capitol Hill.
In fact, the votes for various supporting President Bush resolutions or the Patriot Act that was passed were overwhelmingly in support of those things. So what happens when there's not open dissent within official government circles? The press has a hard time offering dissent of its own.
CNN Newsnight anchor Aaron Brown.
I wish we'd been a little more aggressive in how we covered the Patriot Act when it was working its way through Congress. I think this is a particularly important area to talk about because I think ultimately it is one of the things that history will look at very carefully.
Reports on the impact of government actions like the Patriot Act on civil liberties and access to information came too late, according to many press critics. Bill Kovich, chairman of the Committee of Concerned Journalists and a former editor of the Atlanta Journal and Constitution, says he's concerned that no one he knows has seen fit to create a civil liberties beat to watchdog the government since 9/11. Because, he says, if the public is kept in the dark during times of crisis, when the truth comes out, it ceases to believe in any institutions at all. During World War I, there were powerful photos of men dying in the trenches, but they were censored. The public didn't see them, didn't really know about the war.
As soon as the war ended, those pictures started coming out. And one of the reasons we had what we now call the I don't care age in the early 1920s was the total disillusion of the American public after World War I, when they began to realize, one, we never won the war, two, we didn't get anything out of the war, and three, my God, what we put our poor troops through when they started seeing the pictures. They became totally cynical.
But when the need to know is greatest, many people resist knowing. In recent months, as the news media have become more forthright in their coverage of the war in Afghanistan, the potential war in Iraq, and the war we're waging at home, the patriotism rating of the press plunged 20 percentage points, according to another Pew survey released only last month.
And on 17 measures that we use to judge public opinion of the news media, they were all back pretty much to their pre-9/11 levels.
Andrew Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center, says the public is still satisfied with the information it's getting about the war, but
on patriotism and on a number of values, professionalism, morality, the media has taken some very big hits.
Many journalists might consider patriotism an irrelevancy amid questions gauging fundamental issues of professionalism and credibility. But the low marks on patriotism have sobering implications, because another new poll, conducted annually by a research center at the University of Connecticut, found that, not for the first time, the least popular First Amendment right is freedom of the press, with 42% saying the press in America has too much freedom. Bill Kovich.
Anytime there's a national security alert, anytime there is a sense that the nation is in jeopardy, the public immediately swings to the side of the government and the government's right to keep secrets and urges the press to lay off.
The solution for journalists, says Kovich, is to break from tradition and report not only the information, but also why that information is necessary for a democracy to function. The objections of the people must be anticipated and addressed, says Kovich, so that they fully comprehend the consequences of not knowing.
These things are inextricably bound up, and science may have figured out a way to separate twins joined at the head. But I don't think anyone's figured out how to separate democracy from a journalism that gives them the information they have to have in order to govern themselves.
The Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press notes that it was journalists, not government officials, who pieced together for the public how the 19 hijackers assembled and completed their mission. It was reporters who revealed details on how and why the military and the CIA failed to capture Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. This year, the great newspapers, the most conscientious TV and radio programs, spent past their budgets and trusted their audiences. The best gatekeepers made the decision to place more emphasis on news the public needed than on what it wanted, while keeping their fingers crossed that it was one and the same.
In recent weeks, we have read over and over about the outrage among America's Western European allies against what they see as Bush administration unilateralism in its war footing with Iraq, and about the effect on an increasingly fragile anti-terror coalition. But Western Europe isn't the whole world, so we asked our friend Alice Chasen, editor of World Press Review, to survey her correspondents for an assessment, 1 year into the war on terrorism, about how American policy is playing in the media outside the developed world. She joins us now. Alice, a chorus of anguish, I gather.
what I saw in country after country was this kind of concern that the war against terrorism was going to have an effect on their own well-being, or in fact that they had been ignored by the United States because priorities had radically shifted in the post-September 11th environment.
So they say all politics is local. All reverberations to even watershed historical events turn out to be local as well.
Well, that certainly does seem to be the case. What we saw this time was that there were surprising kinds of reactions. In Latin America, there's been anger in recent months that the economic downturn in the Americas has taken a back seat to security concerns on the part of the Bush administration. In Africa, for instance, our Kenya correspondent told us that Kenyans, although they had, again, great sympathy for the United States, were worried that this war against terrorism was being brought to their own backyard because Somalia and Kenya itself were both named by various Bush administration officials as potentially harboring al-Qaeda.
You mentioned the resentment in Latin America. You specified Argentina and Brazil, saying that they feel abandoned by the administration. Are there any particularly trenchant editorials along those lines?
Just last week, Estoé, which is a weekly news magazine in Brazil, showed George Bush as a vampire on its cover. And behind him was a map of the world with puncture wounds in it in various locations, indicating that the Bush administration was sucking the lifeblood out of Latin America, Brazil to be specific, and then another set of puncture wounds in South/Central Asia. So Estoé is a perfect example of a magazine that last September and October and November was quite sympathetic toward the United States. And now the Brazilian press is filled with angry editorials about the fact that the United States has abandoned them.
Are you saying that it's just a year after September 11th, around the world, a return to the status quo?
In many respects, countries, as they are seen through the prism of their newspapers and magazines, have returned to the status quo ante. But there's still tremendous conflict in the press because whether you're talking about the Shining Path guerrillas in Peru or the ETA in Spain or the Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines, virtually in every part of the world, countries are no strangers to random violence from terroristic acts. But on the other hand, there's tremendous frustration, consternation, bewilderment, anger at the Bush administration.
All right. Alice Chasen, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Alice Chasen is editor of World Press Review.
Up next, what the victims' families took from the media, a debate over press freedom post-9/11 and the American brand.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The families of those who died in the World Trade Center attack are often referred to simply as the families. The families want this, the families feel that. But when it comes to how they feel about media coverage this past year, the so-called families are hardly homogenous. Each has a different relationship with the news. On the Media's Marianne McCune spoke with three women who lost someone they loved.
You figure books about September 11th are made for the people who weren't close to what happened, who want somehow to get nearer to death and destruction. But Susan Carroll's shelves are loaded with them. When she rides alone in her car, sometimes she'll listen to a recording of a series of radio stories about the victims, and her parakeets and dog have had to endure the same TV documentaries twice sometimes. She watches and videotapes them.
Sometimes I think I'm looking for my own answers, that I might see something that I didn't see last time, something that might answer questions that I might have in my own head, questions that I don't even know that I have.
Susan Carroll's son, Kevin Colbert, was an investment banker in the World Trade Center, one of those who died when the buildings collapsed. This year, she says, one of his brothers moved to Florida and his girlfriend went to California, both fatigued by the daily onslaught of information. But Carroll wants to see everything.
It's not real. It's not real yet. But I guess I have to watch it to make it real. I don't have enough. Kevin's dog.
In the beginning, I used to read everything.
Susanna Ferreira's fiancé, John Cruz, worked for Cantor Fitzgerald.
And until they found him faithfully every day, I would buy the Post, and I was kind of running my own chart to see where people were found, and I would write down their names, go on to CNN.com, and see what company they worked for. And I'd do my ratio, and I'd say, okay, well, you know, 4 out of the 6 were Cantor Fitzgerald people. And I'm like, okay, like, they're finding a lot. And I did that until they called us and they told us that they found him, and they didn't find him until the end of February.
Ferreira says she was grateful at the time for something to do, some way to take control. And since then, she's been grateful for the bigger picture the news has given her, like one article about a group of people who were trapped in one of the towers.
They said that they were standing around with 40 other people, and they were just holding hands and they were praying. And, like, just to know that, like, I guess they weren't alone, in a sense, is comforting, because that's how I think. I keep thinking to myself, my God, like, was he by himself?
Ferreira says she sometimes wades through the details of that morning, the points she or John might have made some other choice that might have saved him. And so it actually helped, she says, to watch two French filmmakers' documentary on CBS about the efforts of firefighters that morning. Somehow, seeing them unable to solve the problem relieved her. And when she read about an air traffic controller who knew the planes were heading toward the towers before they hit and also felt terribly guilty, that helped too.
It kind of comforted me because it made me just think that, you know what, like, there was nothing he could do. And the same way with me that day, there was nothing that I could have done.
But that's the kind of story that makes Roxana Batista squirm. She tries painstakingly not to think about who knew what before the planes hit and what they could have done. Reading about it reminds her of a saying in Spanish.
Perro que ladra, no muerde. Don't talk about it. Be about it. I don't need to know. My sister died. Why should I need to know what you could have done? Makes me point the finger at you.
Her 24-year-old sister, Giovanna Porras, is gone from her family's two-story home next to JFK Airport. Batista lives with her husband and two sons, and a mother whose mind, she says, is being corroded by news stories about the failures of the FBI or the fire department or the airlines, even if the reports detail ways to do better next time.
I don't want to point no fingers. I just want to say, okay, she died. It was a tragedy. But if you start showing me about, oh, do you know that there were threats? Or do you know that this person got a letter? Or do you know that there were this? Or do you, why do I need to all of this? Also, all of a sudden, I know that my sister maybe will be alive if you wouldn't being a little more efficient with your work. I don't need to know that.
And when she's forced to think about it, rage eclipses all other emotion.
I hate it. I hate everybody. I do.
And so Batista wishes all that were published in a paper just for the government, just for the people who need to know what to change. Even Susanna Ferreira, who reads almost everything, sometimes wishes she could protect herself from knowing.
I was reading through the New York Times magazine and how they had found one man who had like a quarter of his leg attached to like a piece of pants with like a belt, and they were like, that's specific. And I think at a time like that, family members didn't need to know that, because that was one of the hardest issues we've had to deal with up until now, is knowing that we had this 6-foot guy who, you know, looked amazing, and then to know that they found pieces of him. I actually kept it because I couldn't believe it, how bad it was.
Okay, she says, they have to print it, but they could add a warning, something like, this section will be really tough for family members.
The New York Times actually had an article about 2 months ago that detailed I guess, some of the last phone calls that people were getting, and I had emailed it to his best friend, and he called me, and he said, "Sue, do not read that article." He said, "Please." He said, "Just wait." And so I kind of listened to him.
Susanna Ferreira and Roxana Batista and Susan Carroll don't always want to hear the stories the media want to tell. Sometimes they want to tell the story themselves. Susan Carroll says she worries people will forget her son.
It seems as time goes by, everybody disappears, and you're still left with that emptiness, and I don't want people to forget them. I want people to remember more, and in my way, doing some of these interviews is making sure that nobody forgets them.
It's Carroll's way of tailoring the story of September 11th, shaping it into the story she wants told. She says her son's girlfriend, the one who went to California in part to get out from under the New York media's grasp, has just produced a CD of songs about Kevin. One more spin on a story that far too many people have the bad luck to own. And it's the media's delicate task to tell it all, for them and for the rest of us. In New York, I'm Marianne McCune for On the Media.
As the government seeks to choke off the flow of information to potential terrorists, press freedom activists are concerned that these efforts to preserve secrecy may go too far. For instance, in mid-October, Attorney General John Ashcroft issued a memo telling government officials that if there were any sound legal basis for denying Freedom of Information Act or FOIA requests, the Justice Department would support them. And now the House and Senate are debating whether to exempt another class of information from disclosure under the act. Joining me now to discuss this is Scott Armstrong, a Washington journalist and founder of the National Security Archive, which indexes and makes available declassified documents. Scott, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here again.
And Justice Department spokesperson Barbara Comstock. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
There was a time when the government's default mode was to release information unless they could prove that disclosure would harm national security. Now it seems to be up to the person who wants the information to prove that it won't. So, Barbara, what did Ashcroft intend with that memo?
So, well, it's important to understand that that memo did not change anything in the FOIA law. We're fortunate to have experts who've been here for 20 years and watched the operation of FOIA, and they would tell you that there's no marked difference in the day-to-day disclosure, that there's not a fundamental change in what is being disclosed. All we're asking people is, you know, in light of the circumstances now and in just in general, to consider, you know, the impact that this might have on government operations. And that's something, it's just sort of a caution, and it really goes to discretionary disclosures.
I think Barbara's brought us to exactly the point, which is government disclosure and openness is a discretionary matter. It takes a very patient person to get anything under the Freedom of Information Act by litigating for it. You get it because there's a tendency in the government at career levels to want to let the public know what they're doing. Our concerns have to do with the normal governmental food chain of information, where the public and public interest groups and the press are allowed to ask questions and get more information and begin to make the government accountable. That's where we're beginning to develop our concerns. Part of it came from what happened recently in the Homeland Security Act.
Okay, you're talking about the debate now on Capitol Hill over whether to include in the Homeland Security Act a measure that would allow people to report voluntarily any kind of weakness in our infrastructure, dams, pipelines, power plants, without that information being subject to disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. It's exempted.
Yes, the House has passed a version that has fairly sweeping provisions that would allow industry, local officials, state officials, a wide variety of people to report information, which would then be exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. It's the first time we've really had a situation where the Freedom of Information Act doesn't apply to a category of material like that. It doesn't get compared to some standard to see whether or not it can be released. We don't want a terrorist to know that if you put one stick of dynamite in this particular spot at the chemical plant, you can blow up the plant and cause an entire city to be wiped out. Obviously, we don't want that. On the other hand, if everything that's dangerous becomes something that can be withheld, then we don't learn about the love canals. We don't learn about these toxic brews. Superfund sites become things we don't know about. The unscrupulous factory foreman who's dumping pollutants into the river can say, well, I can't tell you any more about that because if people knew how easy it was to dump pollutants in the river, then the terrorists could come dump pollutants in the river. Everything becomes rationalized as being secret.
Well, I think in that, my understanding of that, and that since it is Homeland Security, I'm sorry, I probably don't have the knowledge as much of our own department, but if a company or people were going to voluntarily turn these things over, they don't want then this voluntary action that they're taking to then somehow be used against them in some type of way.
Well, Barbara, we've seen that state and local governments have been taking cues from the federal government and considering anti-terrorism legislation that would exempt all sorts of quote-unquote sensitive information. If that's the case, how can the watchdogs, namely public interest groups, do their job if information about water supplies and utility plants is suddenly off limits?
Well, I think they're always going to be taken on a case-by-case basis. What you have going on here in all these situations is just be careful out there. There's always been a national security exemption on FOIA, and hopefully people were being careful with those things before.
Scott?
The fact of the matter is that most environmental activities that become the subject of a change in policy or get cleaned up are brought to the attention of the government by citizens who are monitoring what plants and local facilities do. That's precisely the kind of information which could easily be hidden by a voluntary disclosure. Now, eventually, that'll be considered an abuse and you're going to get something. But there could be years involved. When you start creating this kind of a fabric of secrecy that you're weaving and allow other people to weave, it could be woven by any particular part of the bureaucracy or any of the many corporations that have things that are dangerous. So the equation becomes anything that's dangerous is potentially used by terrorists, therefore anything relating to it, and you can be very creative and make that very broad, can be held as a secret.
Okay. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Journalist Scott Armstrong is the founder of the National Security Archive, and Barbara Comstock is spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Justice.
The bombing campaign in Afghanistan had barely ended when advertising executive Charlotte Beers was hired by the Bush administration to head the second phase of the war on terrorism. The so-called Battle for Hearts and Minds has so far yielded Radio Sawa, a station that broadcasts a mixture of Arabic pop and Britney Spears with a smattering of American-style news. We've also seen appearances on the pan-Arab cable channel Al Jazeera of top administration officials, and even a personal plea for peace from Muhammad Ali. But there are some in the marketing business who believe the current campaign is strategically flawed. Marketing consultants Sam Hill and Steve Silver co-authored an article in the current Journal of Business Strategy titled Selling Brand America. Sam Hill joins us now. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
In your article, you say, in terms of target audience, we should ignore the Al-Qaeda terrorists, they're too radicalized, and forget the wealthy elites who are doing just fine with the status quo. But we should be focusing, you say, on the more than half of the Muslim population who look at U.S. economic opportunity and democracy with some measure of envy. All right, how?
Well, I think tactically some of the things we've started to do are good ideas, things like the radio station and broadcasting more TV and sending out videotapes of Muhammad Ali, and all of these things are good ideas to get at those people. But I think we also have to divorce ourselves from things that are at odds with our value proposition. I'm sorry, I know that sounded jargony, but it is very hard for us to advertise about freedom and equality for women and support things like the Saudi government. That's a real note of dissonance. And one thing that we've always said in marketing, and I'm sure you've written it, is everything communicates. So we can't run ads talking about how terrific things would be and at the same time send a very different message through a different set of channels. We have to communicate a consistent story.
It's a mixed message, which immediately is dissonant with the intended audience.
Well, it's a mixed message, and it's a message that's overwhelmed. There's no amount of advertising that can overcome the constant presence on the news media and on other media and in the streets of what these people see every day. So it's just a question of being outweighted in media terms. A couple of 30-second blips aren't going to outdo 24 hours of oppression.
What you're describing really is not a marketing problem, but a distribution problem, because the democracy and the economic opportunity that America has to offer isn't really available. As you say in your piece, it's not on the shelves in most of the Arab world.
We said that we're being out-marketed by a guy whose office is a cave. Al-Qaeda is offering a value proposition that isn't particularly attractive. Benefits that pay off in the afterlife are not inherently a very strong value proposition. And yet, it's beating ours because it's more compelling, it's more clearly articulated, and it goes hand in hand with something that they can actually reach for. So is it a distribution problem? Clearly, distribution's a big piece of it, but I don't think we're helping ourselves on the marketing front either.
Now, when you get through all the marketing talk in your piece, what you describe requires more than American propaganda or more than American advertising. It requires a major change in American politics and policy with regard to some of these oppressive regimes in the Middle East. If it requires such a dramatic change in American policy, isn't it kind of silly to think of it in marketing terms?
Well, but they go hand in hand. I mean, we don't think that there's any set of commercials we can run that is going to reverse the widely held opinion that we favor Israel in the Middle East. That is not going to happen. But we do think that if we set out on a course where we commit to democracy in that area, to opportunity in that area, and if we tell people that and if we keep telling them that it's a useful part of the improvement process, and it also probably serves to hold us to our promise.
So the checklist of items is to find the right audience receptive for the message, to find a means of communicating the message in a way that will be most resonant with this audience, and then finding the media through which to get it through. What is the message?
Well, I think the message is our tagline. America has the best tagline of any country ever, the land of opportunity. That's a great tagline. We would have charged America millions of dollars to develop that tagline if they had hired us to do it. It's a terrific tagline. It's a natural brand positioning. And all we have to do is promise opportunity. I think a lot of the other things that we promise, freedom for women, these sorts of things, different constituencies are ambivalent about in the markets. But I think the land of opportunity, that rings like a bell.
Well, Sam, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Sam Hill is the president of Helios Consulting and the author of 60 Trends in 60 Minutes, published by John Wiley & Sons.
Coming up, why America loves Donald Rumsfeld and how tragedy gave birth to a kinder, gentler culture. Not.
This is On the Media from NPR. We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In this media-saturated age, effective leaders don't use media to convey their power. Their use of media is power. Norman Schwarzkopf's bombs were not nearly as precision-guided as his disarming appearances in the Gulf War press room, and standing on the shoulders of that military giant comes Donald Rumsfeld. OTM's producer-at-large Mike Pesca has more.
Remember Donald Rumsfeld before 9/11? He was portrayed as some sort of phantom of the Pentagon, lurking the halls since the last days of the Ford administration. In August 2001, the online magazine Slate predicted his ouster and initiated a Rumsfeld death watch based on rumors that his reforms were going nowhere. The Chicago Tribune reported that Rumsfeld's to-do memos were derided as snowflakes behind his back, and UPI actually described him with the phrase publicity shy. But the minute he opened his mouth, he sounded as polished as a longtime syndicated talk show host.
You know, it's perfectly possible for anyone to stand up and say, Henny Penny, the sky's falling. Isn't this terrible? What's happening? And have someone else say, gee, I view with alarm the possibility that the sky's falling. And then it gets repeated. And then some breathless commentator repeats it again. And then it goes on for 3 days. Now, does that make it so? No.
Rumsfeld's performance immediately following 9/11 and in daily press conferences for the first few months afterwards won him the respect of many who never before thought that a Pentagon briefing could be a rollicking good time. Fans were born overnight, fans like Kim Fustier.
He tells the truth. That's the most important thing. He's blunt, he's straightforward, and he's also very funny.
Fustier is not your stereotypical defense wonk. She just turned 20 on Monday, and most surprising to the visitors of the internet site she erected to honor Rumsfeld, she's French.
Actually, I've never even seen a single press briefing by a French cabinet member on French television. We've never had it like a celebrity politician, like a star, a TV star. We've never had that.
Much like the French Revolution itself, Fustier's fervor had its roots in America, where millions of anxious citizens in the wake of the terrorist attacks were drawn to the well-spoken secretary with the Jack Palancian complexion, the Eastwood-esque squint, and, to complete the cowboy trifecta, the swagger of a John Wayne.
You will receive only honest, direct answers from me, and they'll either be that I know and I'll answer you, or I don't know, or I know and I won't answer you. And that'll be it.
The public's infatuation with Rumsfeld even extended to the press corps. Take Mike Linaw, who relishes the briefings as a chance to capture Rumsfeld's reactions through his telephoto lens.
I'll zoom in on his face and I'll watch real closely to see if he does react, to see if he gives a little, you know, what are you talking about thing, or if the eyebrow might come up a little bit. But it's fun looking for little subtleties like that.
Linaw's vocation is photography, but his avocation is Rumsfeld. He's the moderator of the Yahoo Rumsfeld chat group, which had over 1,000 messages last month, many of them like this one.
What some people see as wit, others see as sarcasm. Some see a man who's a natural and inspiring leader. Others see an autocratic control freak. Those things are traits of mere mortals, like Bush, Cheney, Powell, and Condi Rice. The last three people are brilliant, but only Rummy is a genius. I don't think it's an understatement to say when we aren't sure about a value or a decision in life, we can't go wrong by asking ourselves, what would Donald Rumsfeld do?
What Rumsfeld does in a press conference is disarm would-be interrogators with a series of preemptive strikes. For instance, he'll dismiss a question about the condition of the detainees at Guantanamo by portraying the very question as part of a blame America sentiment.
A thread I find from time to time, the implication is that America is what's wrong with the world, and in fact, it's not.
He handled a question about the Northern Alliance's treatment of prisoners the same way.
There's no question but that if someone looked down from Mars on the United States for the last 3 days, they would conclude that America is what's wrong with the world. America is not what's wrong with the world.
Another of Rumsfeld's tools is his avoidance of phrases like collateral damage. Even though he often uses bluntness of tone as a substitute for clarity, his distaste for euphemism when talking about war is appreciated by most of the press.
When there's a war and people are shooting and things happen, and there's no question that there are people getting killed. I don't doubt that for a minute.
He leavens the bombast with old-fashioned words which have been dubbed rummy speak.
Darn good. You bet. Gee.
But the rhetorical device that connects most with the public is his use of humor.
Yeah. Did I use the word frenzy?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, to the president as well.
Caught on tape.
Credit to the president.
Well, let me have an agonizing reappraisal here for a moment.
In fact, the joking has gotten to the point where NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Gelton and his colleagues have resorted to asymmetrical warfare in order to combat the Defense Department's primary evasion tactic.
I mean, we've actually said, you know, don't laugh at his jokes. Don't laugh at his jokes because, you know, it's just going to give him an excuse not to answer the questions.
CBS's Dave Martin, who's covered the Pentagon for 20 years, has found another strategy.
Something I started doing when Bill Cohen was Secretary of Defense. I don't go to the briefings. I just sort of decided I was tired of being used as a prop for sound bites. And it hasn't hurt me that I can tell.
The reason it hasn't hurt, and Martin says that none of the big stories he's reported this year have relied on a press briefing, is that Rumsfeld's quotes sound great, but they don't always explain what's going on in the war. Tom Gelton.
When I was becoming a radio reporter, you know, one of the rules that I was always taught is to, you know, go first for the good tape, because in the business of broadcast, you always want to catch people's attention. But then you have to kind of take a second listen and you realize that he's not saying anything, or he's not answering the question, or he's not providing the information that he really is being asked to provide. And so you have to think, well, wait a minute, should I use that or not?
The key to Rumsfeld's success is that his briefings aren't significantly more informative, they're just more entertaining. The very same criticism has been lodged against the media. And with the majority of Americans dependent on TV news, 24-hour cable channels desperate for programming, and ratings-driven newscasts dependent on strong sound bites, the Rumsfeld briefing must rank right up there among the most successful operations the Pentagon has mounted to date. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Who's making these reports?
From the ground. Who? Witnesses from the ground.
Who?
To the reporters.
UN officials.
UN officials.
Are reporting that they are reporting.
I don't think there are any UN officials in there. I think there may be some people.
We should finally now confess that we weren't eager to devote an entire program to the media aftermath of 9/11.
As more than casual observers of media overkill, we didn't wish ourselves to flog a horse that is already being quite pummeled in most every other media channel on Earth. In the end, though, we decided that our responsibility is no different than any other media outlet to consider the questions most relevant and most resonant to our audience. And this week, there is no debate about what that topic is.
With the understanding that a certain part of our listenership would quickly abandon us for music or sports or just plain silence, we decided to take the long, hard look that only a year's perspective can furnish. Because one of the phenomena we discovered in surveying the mass media implications of calamity is that short, superficial looks can yield distorted results.
One of the first questions after the planes hit was, what would happen? What would happen to New York, to the perpetrators, to the economy, and beyond all of the immediate ramifications of catastrophe, to us? If the Kennedy assassination marked the end of American innocence, as is widely accepted, and the Vietnam War and Watergate supposedly turned us cynical, what of 9/11? If it was a transforming event, if it was a historical turning point, what precisely would turn? The answer from most everybody's lips was the culture.
9/11 will go down in American history as one of the profound cultural traumas that will imprint itself on the cultural memory of the society, about which we will not be able to forget.
Neil Smelser is professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley.
And which will have the same significance of events such as the Civil War, Pearl Harbor, perhaps the Great Depression, all in different ways, of course, but which embed themselves in the national consciousness. And you really can't think about the society or the culture in the same way as you did before.
Academics were by no means alone in that assessment. Graydon Carter, editor of Vanity Fair magazine, declared a seismic change and echoing a Time magazine essay by Roger Rosenblatt, predicted the end of irony. In Hollywood, various potentates bade farewell to violent entertainment and to all things trivial. On September 13th, TV producer Bryce Zabel was to have had a meeting pitching USA Networks on a miniseries called World War III. The meeting and the project were canceled as irrelevant. Warner Brothers stopped the October release of an Arnold Schwarzenegger action flick about a firefighter seeking vengeance against terrorists. It was deemed just too gratuitous in the wake of real terror. In the somber, self-reflective post-9/11 environment, said movie producer and former Universal Studios chief Tom Pollock, he, quote, wouldn't even pitch a comedy, because everything and everybody had changed. Everything and everybody had changed until about February, when Schwarzenegger's Collateral Damage was released. Despite mostly lousy reviews, it's done $54 million so far. The somber, self-reflective Austin Powers in Goldmember has done more than $200 million. Oh, and by the way, The Osbournes. And oh, by the way, American Idol. Network TV ratings since 9/11, for the first time in 15 years, are up.
The landscape doesn't look dramatically different.
TV producer Bryce Zabel, author of The Stillborn World War III, is president of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences.
The truth of the matter is, the American public wants to look at their programming primarily for entertainment. They know they get the news from news channels, but they tend to look for entertainment from the rest of the dial.
Society is pretty much going back to being who they are, and I think they went back fairly fast. I think they have the same appetite for the same entertainment, and actually it's sort of insatiable. It's amazing.
Brooke Kennedy is an executive producer of the CBS drama Third Watch about New York police and firefighters. Her show, owing to its subject matter, was among the pop culture creations explicitly affected by 9/11. The writers and producers had to balance the narrative duty to acknowledge the attacks without appearing to be disrespectful or exploitive.
I mean, we knew certain topics that we wanted to stay away from immediately. I mean, we wanted to stay away from collapses, things that we had done in the past. You know, you're afraid to go near those things. You're afraid to fictionalize somebody's pain.
One of the assumptions was that the entire nation's nerves were rubbed so raw, much popular fare would be rendered unbearable, especially anything with inherent attitude, irreverence, condescension, irony. Essayist Roger Rosenblatt.
Before September 11th, and for the last, I don't know, 5-7 years, the sense of things being ironic, that everything was to be greeted with a smirk and a kind of twist of the lips, became a modus operandi to greet all of experience. And so when I and you and everyone else saw what happened on 9/11, it just occurred to me that that would wipe the smirk off most people's face.
Well, there was briefly a de-smirking of America. David Letterman took a hiatus and returned, minus jokes, with a distraught Dan Rather. Comedy Central ran an on-screen banner for the Red Cross Victims Relief Fund. Politically Incorrect's Bill Maher was excoriated and his show ultimately canceled after a remark that besmirched the U.S. military. And then the smart alecks, such as Comedy Central's ultra-ironic Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, returned.
Stephen, what about reports of atrocities that are being committed by the Northern Alliance? I mean, we've seen some images in the newspaper that are very disturbing.
Oh, no, you haven't. Friend could never communicate what I've seen. Let me tell you, I'm right here, and oh, that is disturbing. That is what I call an atrocity. Oh, nope, sorry, stand corrected. That is an atrocity. Wait a second. Sorry, I thought you were done. No, you were committing an atrocity. Kudos. That is truly atrocious.
Jeffrey Ross is a New York City stand-up comic.
I'm a college-educated guy, and oftentimes I would say, what am I doing? Making people laugh or help sell drinks for comedy club owners? Is this really what my life's calling should be? And with the risk of sounding corny, when something like this, no, not like this, when this happened, the job description became clear to me for the first time. Human beings are made to mourn and then move on. And the comedian's job is to help people move on. When you're ready, you come to us, but we're here.
and people did come back because after the storm, the waters eventually find their level, and that level is never much changed. Even cataclysm does not turn our cultural worlds upside down for long, nor our home lives, nor our work lives, nor even necessarily our patriotism. Chris Gwynn of Fridgedoor.com sells refrigerator magnets.
After September 11th, there was just a huge surge in demand for anything patriotic. We went from selling pretty much zero in August to, in September, we sold about 8,000 patriotic magnets. October, we sold about 20,000 pieces. Then November, it started to go down. We sold about 5,000 pieces. And then December, 4,000. January, 3,000. And then it just sort of leveled back to, not nothing, but we might sell 100 a month now. The people that we bought from still have warehouses full of patriotic items that they're trying to sell at any price.
When conspicuous display of patriotism turns out to be a blip, it's obvious that the gears of social change turn very slowly, so we should take care of what conclusions we draw. Here's a scene from CBS's Third Watch, two cops gazing at the scarred tableau of Lower Manhattan.
I don't think I'll ever get used to it.
What?
The downtown skyline. You think it'll ever be normal again, boss?
What's normal?
The way it was.
No.
Good acting, nice dialogue, and a poignant definition of normal. But consider the metaphor. The New York skyline is indeed changed forever. It's also, strictly speaking, counting all the rooftops, 99% the same. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by Dylan Keefe and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl, and this week we say a grudging farewell to our beloved assistant producer, Sean Landis, without whom it sometimes seems this show would not be possible.
Sean, please don't go. What can grad school give you that we can't?
Eventually, a job with decent pay, reasonable hours, and a future?
Nah. Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Beidel Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.